What is up, and welcome back to 24 Minutes of the Oscars, the podcast that takes a look at the 2024 Oscars 24 minutes at a time. I'm Ethan Simi.
And I'm Ben Lawhorn. This week on the pod, we are trying to build our dream life directly across from Auschwitz as we speak about Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest.
Auschwitz Commandant Rudolf Haas and his wife Hedwig strive to build a dream life for their family in a house and garden beside the camp. This is Best Picture number 9. Ben, we are almost at the end here. We've covered 8 Best Picture nominees. We have one to go next week. Mm-hmm. And then just a couple days before the Oscars, we are going to come out with like a final predictions pod, which is probably going to be very hectic and very fun. I'm excited for that. I'm really excited to talk about The Zone of Interest. We have an incredible guest joining us here, critic for Next Best Picture and entertainment reporter for The Desert Sun. Emma Sasek is joining us to talk about The Zone of Interest. Emma, welcome to the pod. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing so well. How are you?
Doing great. Super stoked to have you.
I think I'm doing about as well as I can knowing what we're going to talk about for the next hour. So we'll see how that goes. Of course, we'll kind of talk about the Oscars. I think it's important that we briefly talk about SAG reactions. I think like that's the very kind of last big precursor that we got. Of course, it was SAG, PGA, and Independent Spirit Awards this past weekend. SAG being, you know, probably the most important out of those precursors. And I've got some questions around that, so maybe that'll lift our spirits just a tad. Emma, we always like to start our Oscar episode by asking our guests how they feel about the Academy Awards. What do they mean to you? Are they near and dear to your heart? How much of your personal sanity do you put into this completely made-up award show?
Oscar and I go way, way back. I remember all the times when my mom would let me stay up to watch the awards, and I was like, best mom award right here. Nice. I from a young age, I've loved films and I've always loved watching them with my parents. And thankfully, they allowed me to watch pretty much anything. Maybe I shouldn't have watched Eyes Wide Shut as a 6-year-old, but it's okay. They have formed who I am to this day. But I've always loved them. It's always exciting. Like the moment right before the envelope is read, you're always like, is it going to go the way that I think? Is it not going to go? You have those little butterflies in some of those major categories. So I love it. Yes, have they gotten it right many times? Yes. Have they not gotten it right many times? Yes, absolutely. So it's frustrating, but it's like a love-hate relationship. You just keep coming back to it. And this year is no different because I am still like stressed about so many categories, even though I feel like it has to go this way, right?
Exactly, exactly. And then, yeah, at the end of it all, you're just like, none of it really matters, you know, but it's so chaotic.
Yeah. Then you're just like, oh, I guess I'll never talk about this movie ever again. Okay, cool. Yep.
Moving on to next year.
Wow. Yeah. Code of slander right out of the gate. That's brutal.
No, I didn't say anything.
I think that's really funny that you bring that up. I want to quickly just tell a little story. My family and I just got back from Kauai a couple of days ago. Oh. And unbeknownst to me, being so like attached to precursors and the Oscars and all of these things, I for some reason went like full vacation mode, and I was like, let's reserve our one fancy dinner in the middle of the SAG Awards. Why not? That sounds great. Good. And so we did that, and that was tough. That was a bad idea because I missed most of the telecast. But I will say, the SAG Awards started as we were driving to the place, and I had to hold my phone basically behind me to my children in the back seats because they were so interested in the people talking, and they love watching these. They watched the Critics Choice with me. They'll watch the Oscars, even though I won't be home for those. I feel like I'm doing something right. Like if you know, that mold hopefully you know, kind of represents something that you became, Emma. So I feel pretty good about that. They really care, and they're only 5 and 3. So I feel like that's a big win.
Start them young. That's all I have to say. As long as you can, whatever passion you might have, if you can share with that with your kids, even in like the tiniest ways, I feel like that ends up being like lifelong memories that they get to look back on forever. So good dad award over here.
Yes, we did it.
I'm just looking forward. to the Kubrick themed birthday party next year. I think it's gonna be fantastic. Yeah. You know,
number six.
That's the way to go.
Number six is the year. Maybe number seven could be like Titanic. Because that progression.
I was huge into Titanic when I was a kid. I watched the double VHS, so I think it's perfect. I think we're moving in the right direction. Ben, I got one question for you. As we get closer, this year's a little different, it feels like. Maybe, maybe not, because Everything Everywhere All at Once last year kind of had this like split with Dune, I guess, if you want to say. Or I guess, Dune is kind of similar the year before. But Everything Everywhere All at Once, obviously bringing home tons of awards, setting records for both A24 and for, you know, all kinds of things. Oppenheimer feels like it's going to do quite well this year. And so I'm curious from your perspective, because I know you're not like an Oppenheimer guy on my level. So what is your, like, what is your stress levels about, like, well, Oppenheimer is probably going to take home 5, 6, 7 awards, and really I only have to care about these other 4 or 5 categories?
First of all, I would just like to clarify, I don't think 99% of people are Oppenheimer people on your level. You make me sound like the outlier here, but I think it's the other way around.
Should I very quickly state that I did, in fact, watch Oppenheimer on the flight to Kauai, because I turned it on because I thought my kids were going to need some serious parental advisement during the 6-hour flight. And I was like, well, fuck it. Like, I'll just watch 30 minutes of Oppenheimer. That's going to be great. Like, this is perfect. My kids just let me watch the whole 3-hour run. And so I've got tons of movies to watch for this pod, to watch for other drafts coming up on the Movie Draft podcast. Yeah. And I was like, let's just run Oppenheimer for an 8th time. If that's what you're implying, I'm okay taking that belt. I feel good about
eight times. This man has spent 24 hours.
I made it to the 24-hour mark. I feel so good about that.
An entire day of his life just on one movie. It's crazy. Yeah, I mean, my thoughts on Oppenheimer aside, I will go back to my very first Letterboxd review, which just said it's probably going to win every award and it deserves it. You know, like, the movie may or may not have been for me, but it's impossible to argue the craft behind it and some of the skills. So it's like, I've just like, you know, it's going to happen. And that's cool. That, like, it is kind of fun when it happens, when you get a Return of the King or Everything Everywhere. It's like, oh, it's, but then it also just creates these questions of like, well, what about screenplay? Like, are they going to give it to someone else? Just so like Oppenheimer doesn't win everything. Like, that creates this like weird narrative in my head of like, well, who do I predict now? So I don't know. There's some that feel like just like guaranteed locks, but it's also created some confusion in other areas.
At the time that this podcast will come out, Oscar voting will have ended just a few days ago. And of course, the yearly infamous anonymous voter kind of, I don't know, expressions from people that we always get every year. This year, of course, I think as the day we're recording, the big one kind of going around, going viral, is that one voting member in particular didn't want to finish Killers of the Flower Moon because they thought it was too long. And I'm curious, Emma, just quickly, what is your stance on like Academy voters and sometimes maybe like their inability to connect or pour the time into films that like maybe you and I and Ben might do way too many times?
Well, I mean, it is disappointing when you read that because you think, well, you're a member of this prestigious group that is dedicated to motion pictures and celebrating them. It's like, you really can't like finish a film. I get it. Not every film is for everybody. And there certainly have been some movies that I really haven't been able to finish, not the case this year, but you know, in the past. But I'm not a member of the Academy. So I would expect that my members of these organizations to be able to do that, to finish it, and then to accurately portray that and say, I made the college attempt to watch everything. Here are my picks for that. So, I mean, it stinks. I really don't even bother to read those anonymous ballots anymore. Sometimes I'll see that. I did see that, the one that you're referencing. And it was just another one of those, oh, here we go, type of things.
It feels frustrating because it's like these people have access to this thing that so many of us want. And they're just like, they couldn't be bothered to finish a 3-hour movie. And it's just like, listen, it may not be Scorsese's best movie. It's still a really good movie, though. Like, just give it the time it deserves. But yeah, it can be frustrating.
And I think it's also that thing, too, of like watching it at home on a screener versus watching it in a theater. Like,
for sure.
I had an opportunity to see this at Cannes at the premiere, and it was like amazing to watch that in the theater. At home, maybe not as, you know, exciting. So maybe that comes in there too. But I mean, God knows that they have had like multiple opportunities to watch these screeners in the theater itself too.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. I think it's really interesting because everybody does have access to the Academy portal, of course, and so they get access to these movies in their homes. The first couple of times I saw Killers of the Flower Moon in IMAX, I was like stunned. I was like, this is just incredible, epic, and sweeping. And then I rewatched it for our pod here, and I watched it at home, and I was like, whoa, this, like, we're just lacking the hit that a big screen brings. But of course, you get all kinds of Academy screeners showing up at like the Academy Theater and things like that for many months prior to Academy voting. So there's a lot there, of course. My very last Oscars question before we do Zone of Interest. It has now been confirmed that I'm Just Ken will be performed live by Ryan Gosling and Mark Bronson. Emma, I know you're stoked about this. You tweeted about it a long time ago, right?
I did. I gave them this idea. So you are so welcome, Academy, and every watcher of this. I'm just waiting for my, I had a dream that Ryan Gosling performed this with all the other Kens, and it was a medley of Push and I'm Just Ken. So let's get it. Let's get in touch, Academy. I got you on this. I have the whole idea in mind.
I love it. That'd be amazing. I'm excited about that performance. It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be pretty cool. It seems like, especially with the kind of first trailer clip commercial that we've gotten for the Academy Awards this year, it seems like it's trending in a good direction. I feel like the energy is good, or the Kenergy, I guess, if you want. so we'll see. I'll obviously, like, I always try to tamper my expectations because something is not going to go the way that either I want it, or they're going to miss out on a big opportunity to perform something, or, you know, they're not gonna use 50 cents PIMP to play people off from their speeches. Anything's possible. You know, what could be. Okay, let's talk about the Zone of Interest. So nominated for 5 Oscars this year, of course, Best Picture, which is why we're covering it here on this show, Best Director in Jonathan Glazer, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Sound, and Best International Feature. Now, Ben, you and I we discussed the Best Director race, quote unquote, last week on the Maestro pod, because I went really haywire and just put it out there that I think Bradley Cooper deserved to be in that conversation.
Yes,
and that took up like 25 minutes of our pod. So I will not digress onto that again today, even though I still feel strongly about that. I honestly, it seems to me like it'll take home 1, maybe 2 Oscars, but I'm really curious. Emma, I'll start with you. Do you think it's going to take any home? Do you think it has a shot to win any of these 5 categories?
I pretty much have had it winning Best International Feature Film for a while now. I mean, I think this is certainly one of those films that stays with you for a very, very long time. And it's been talked about that it's probably the most unique Holocaust drama that we have had too, because of the way that it tackles its subject by basically not even talking about it. And it just has such a harrowing, disgusting feeling about it. So I think it's really a lock for that category. I don't know what to do with Best Sound because, you know, they might go the obvious route, I suppose, with Oppenheimer, which has wonderful sound work. But the complexities behind the sound in the Zone of Interest and the story that the sound tells versus the visual story that you get with this movie is so compelling. And I think Johnny Byrne did a fabulous job with this. I actually had an opportunity to speak with him a few weeks ago where I got to learn a little bit more about the behind the scenes work and just everything that he had to research and to figure out what 24 hours sounded like at Auschwitz was a very, very hard undertaking for him. And this would be a really amazing way to honor that because it is such a unique way to tell the story via sound. And then I feel like anything could take adapted screenplay at this point. I think this is another really hard category. I'm not leaning towards Zone of Interest for that, but I think a case could honestly be made for any of the 5 films that are nominated for that. But yeah, I think Best Sound might be like its best second Oscar if there is an opportunity for one.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you 100%. I think the sound is the dark horse here that it could. It's so interesting because, like you said, it has its own complexity. It's like there's a whole different narrative just through the sound in this movie. It presents its own storyline, and it's just so interesting. Like, again, obviously, as you mentioned, just to repeat, like Oppenheimer, great sound design. Like it's the movie wouldn't be nearly as impactful without the sound that it got. I totally understand that, but I feel like the sound affects this movie more than the sound affects Oppenheimer, if that makes sense. So for me, I would give this to Zone of Interest for best sound, because I think if you remove this, it's just a completely different story. And I don't know. I just think it's so powerful, everything they were able to achieve. Obviously, international feature as well. It would be interesting if France had nominated Anatomy of a Fall and we had that race going on between the two of them.
I was going to ask
like
you,
that could have been there.
If that happened, do you think it goes to Zone or goes to Anatomy?
I mean, the way Anatomy's won some of these screenplay awards and things like that, like I might lean towards Anatomy, but now that that's not there, it kind of feels like it's Zone of Interest to lose. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm just repeating everything Emma already eloquently said, but international feature seems like a lock. I would love for it to win sound, but it's up against a behemoth, so we'll see.
So just to be clear, none of us are predicting Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 to win Best Sound at the Academy Awards this year.
That's we'll save we it for agree. Part 2.
It's not even
going to
be called Part 2, though. This isn't even called Part 1 anymore. What's going on? I agree with you guys. I think Best International Feature is definitely a lock. I would be much more interested in that race if Anatomy of Fall did get nominated. Of course, from what I've heard, I have not seen The Taste of Things, but from what I have heard, that is a superior movie to many when it comes to kind of The Taste of Things or Anatomy of Fall.
It's delicious.
Yeah, so it seems to me like France maybe did make the right pick for their country, maybe not for the Academy Awards. So I think it's Zone. I think Best Sound, I think that's the biggest piece for Zone of Interest to win. I don't think this is going to really have a shot at a Best Adapted Screenplay, but I think I'm much like starkly different than most people on the Adapted Screenplay race. Like, I understand people think American Fiction might have some steam and Zone of Interest might have some steam. And of course, you've got Barbie in the conversation. But like, I don't really see how personally, like, it doesn't go to Oppenheimer. And that's like my personal Oppenheimer, you know, veil speaking here of like, we made a 3-hour movie of just people talking from like a 1,000-page book. And I think that is pretty substantial. I don't think Glazer's going to win, obviously. And I don't think this has a Best Picture shot. But I think it's really fascinating that it is going to take home an Academy Award, and I think it's much warranted for a movie like this. I'm sure, Emma, you probably know many more details than we do about maybe like how, you know, the interworkings of the movie, how it was made. But from what I've read and what I know, truly kind of like a brand new way of creating a film like this from Jonathan Glazer, and just kind of uprooting how things like these are a Holocaust movie is done, and just like putting cameras and telling people like, just go about your business and move and do things. And like, that's how we're going to make the movie, which is truly astounding to me. So if I want to like backtrack on my best director, it's not Glazer thing. That's me talking myself out of that. And like towards like Glazer might have a shot. I think we all know it's going to Christopher Nolan. I don't think there's a real competition there. But I think it's kind of crazy that like we're not like, okay, best director, number one, Christopher Nolan, number two, it's got to be Scorsese. Like, I think it's just number one and everybody else, which is kind of wild, especially when it comes to Killers of the Flower Moon. I really, really fast want to talk about SAG reactions. Killers of the Flower Moon, this is the big one that I wanted to talk about. Lily Gladstone wins Best Actress at the SAG Awards. It seems like her and Emma Stone are kind of trading off awards, and I think that is going to be our most interesting and fascinating race to watch when it comes down to it on March 10th. Who's going to take home the Oscar? Ben, are you leaning towards Emma Stone or Lily Gladstone?
Lily Gladstone for sure. Not that Emma Stone doesn't deserve it, but I don't know, and maybe Emma can clarify this for me. Has Emma Stone won against Lily Gladstone yet? So I know she won the BAFTA, and I know she won the Golden Globe, but obviously wasn't up against Lily Gladstone. Yeah. Has she won against her in any of these awards?
The only one was the Critics' Choice Awards, but of course that is like a whole different voting body.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, with that,
so we don't know. We really don't know what's going to happen.
It's going to be interesting, but I'm going towards Lily. Not that, again, I'd be fine if Emma won as well, because I think that's a wonderful performance in Poor Things, but I'm leaning towards Lily for sure.
What about you, Emma?
Yeah, this is like forcing me to pick between my two mothers this year, unfortunately. But I too am leaning toward Lily Gladstone. I mean, like, what can you say aside from like hearing those screams and just those quiet moments that you get to spend with her? It was like the best part of the film for me and the most moving part of it. So I will be beyond happy if it's Lily. I will also be beyond happy if it's Emma, because again, amazing performances. Why is Best Actress like always the best race, but also the hardest one to predict? It drives me nuts every single year.
It's tough for sure. I think it's going to be Lily Gladstone. I think she's campaigned quite well, especially with her winning like speeches that she's given. Everybody seems to just completely fall in love with her every single time she gets up and accepts awards. And that's especially true at SAG. We saw Emma Stone react quite intensely to her winning the award. We saw John Lithgow just like be super pumped about Lily Gladstone giving a great speech. So I feel like there's a lot of juice there. And I feel like the right voting bodies are going to recognize that. I think it's a little insane that that is probably the only Oscar that Killers of the Flower Moon is going to take home, which is wild to me. I don't know. It's no different than Scorsese's history with the Academy. So like, it's not out of line or anything. I just think it's crazy because like that is an incredible film. One of the best movies of 2023 for sure.
Yeah. When I, after I saw Oppenheimer and Killers, I really thought that those two would be going neck and neck, because both of them are dealing with really tough subject matters and having to think about America's histories and how that has impacted the future and the people back then. And it was just like both of these really hard lessons and like, I guess, you know, just like reckonings.
Yeah.
And Killers has just entirely fallen out of the conversation. Like, I don't even know what could technically be like number two in this race. Cause again, it seems like it's Oppenheimer and kind of everything else. Cause it could be like maybe Zone of Interest, you know, is a number two. Because again, another reckoning with the past and how it applies to our present and futures. But it's like, I just don't know what people are feeling and thinking because of the steam train that Oppenheimer has been on.
It's not Maestro. We know that. We know Maestro's not number two. But other than that,
I don't think so.
You did not need to do that. Nobody asked. Nobody asked for your Maestro power rankings.
I just had to make it known.
We can just accept in our hearts, like, you know what? It just came out the wrong year. It's okay. Maestro's a great film.
Just had to poke the bear a little bit more.
Yeah, come on, guys. Come on. Yeah, you know, I think it's tough. I think it's Oppenheimer and 6 Feet of Sand and everything else. I think like it's a tough situation for the Best Picture race. I know a lot of people think Poor Things.
I will challenge you a little bit though. I'm not 100% convinced on Oppenheimer taking adapted screenplay. It could if they just want to give it everything. Mm-hmm. But I do think American Fiction is picking up a lot of steam. I mean, it has picked up quite a few screenplay nominations. Like BAFTA, it won the Spirit Award, but I understand that was a different, you know, list of movies, but I do think it is putting up a pretty good race right now.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I think adapted screenplay is one of the more up in the air categories for sure. I think it's kind of wild, like all the talk and like kind of social clamoring of Barbie, and like that's just not in a conversation really outside of costume or production design, which is pretty wild as it is as well. Like that's in that adapted screenplay category, and I don't really think that's going to have a big shot in that category. But yeah, it could totally be Zone of Interest, which I think would be really, really fascinating. Which is a great lead in to us actually talking about Zone of Interest. Emma, I'll start with you. What are your general thoughts on the movie? So we can establish a baseline here before we go through the film.
Yes. I remember walking out of the theater because this was another film that I had an opportunity to see at Cannes. And I just remember sitting in silence for like half an hour and being really disturbed and disgusted and just kind of being like, wow, they just like made a whole movie without once really talking about the issue at hand and acknowledging what is wrong with this picture. And it's just kind of like stayed with me, that feeling of it being just so disturbing. But it's such an incredibly brilliant and honestly, probably very true depiction of that time period. And for the people who were in charge and overseeing these concentration camps throughout Poland, it was just, yeah, it was just unlike anything that I've seen before, for a number of ways, including the sound, as we talked about, and really just addressing a Holocaust drama, and just so unique. And I don't know, it really surprised me to see that it was from Jonathan Glazer. I mean, Under the mm-hmm. Skin, you know, maybe you could say that one is also a very out there type of film in terms of the way that it followed some alien type creature. But this one really, really surprised me. I guess I don't want to say pleasantly surprised because there's nothing pleasant about this film. But it was just, I just thought it was such a great moment for him to showcase his artistry.
Yeah, I totally agree. Ben?
This is a movie, I think I'm realizing that I'm appreciating things more on a second watch. Mm-hmm. I've come around to that. Like, we recently rewatched Priscilla, which I enjoyed a lot the first time, but rewatched it, I was like, okay, yeah, this is actually better than I remember it. Obviously, Oppenheimer, my thoughts changed a little bit, and it changed on this one as well, because after I saw it the first time, I knew it was good, and I knew that it, like, the message it was giving was powerful. Part of me wondered, like, could this have been as effective as a short film? You know, mm-hmm. like, did the extra hour and a half add that much? You know what I mean? Or could this have been told in 20 minutes and still gotten the same message across? And I don't know that I could have done that entirely. You know, I gave it, I think the first time I gave it like 3.5 stars, something like that, which like is still good. You know what I mean? Like I knew it was a good movie. It just like maybe didn't affect me the way that I was seeing it hit all these other people. I think that's the rough part of it too, of just like being too online, you know, it's like seeing everyone's like reactions to it 2 weeks before it comes out. And it's like, oh shit, this thing's going to fucking blow my mind. And then I watch it and it's like, no, I mean, it was really good, but you know, maybe my expectations were too high. But watching it the second time, it hit me a lot harder, and I realized like it does need this runtime to really drive home almost the mundanity of just like everyday life, you know, and these people just like living their existence without much concern for what's going on 20 feet away from them. You know, it's just like kind of sort of in that ending itself hit so much harder this time as well. So I was very, very glad to rewatch this before we talked about it, because I do know like my feelings on it definitely changed. You know, we talked earlier about international film and maybe Anatomy of Fall with taking it, but I think this thing really deserves any awards that it's going to get. It's a very powerful film. And like Emma said, it's like it tells so much without telling some of any of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that sentence didn't make sense, but it did in my head. But like we learn so much about something by not experiencing it at all, yeah. Which is just kind of crazy. So yeah, so it's a great film. I'd recommend it. Again, like, it's a weird thing to say to recommend this, but I would tell anybody to watch this.
Yeah. I got the chance to watch it at New York Film Festival. And I actually got to watch it with Matt Neglia, Emma, who I believe you work with.
I may have heard of his name.
Little guy named Matt. I had kind of heard coming out of some other festivals, like, be prepared for the Zone of Interest. Like, it's unlike anything you've ever seen. And I think it definitely held up to that standard. I think our entire theater that night, because that was like the final movie of the night, just like you said, Emma, we just kind of like sat and people were just like silent and like stunned of what we just watched. I think the first time that I saw it, it was very overwhelming to take in just truly like what it was trying to wrap its arms around and what it was trying to display and talk about. And it does leave you with like that really dirty, griming, disassociative feeling of like, I don't want to try to figure it out because I just would rather not dive into that and like say that, yeah, this is what happened. Like this is real. I watched it the second time a few weeks ago, and just like the theatrical experience for this movie, I know we've talked about best sound, is unbelievable. It is truly something that deserves to be seen in a really dark room on the biggest screen possible, with tons of people, because you get that mutual buy-in from everybody in the theater, instead of like just yourself on your couch with your phone 5 feet away from you, where it's like you're locked into what's happening and everybody. And I think it's a very interesting like cinematic proposition, because everybody's buying into this very dark, disturbing thing that we're all watching, and all might react to differently. I know the second time that I saw it, some of these scenes that we're going to kind of cover and talk about, I reacted like quite viscerally to, even though I knew that they were coming. And so I think like knowing they were coming hit me a little bit stronger and a little bit harder. This, of course, is the first of two A24 movies nominated for Best Picture. Emma, you mentioned Under the Skin, Jonathan Glazer's other A24 film. Very fascinating career dynamic for Glazer, going from that with a tried and true Hollywood, beautiful Hollywood star in Scarlett Johansson, being kind of this man luring alien, and having this like huge conversation about, you know, sexuality and social stigmas and everything that that movie includes, which I've really turned around on that movie. I did not like it the first time I saw it. And then I saw Zone of Interest and I was like, I get Glazer now. Like something has unlocked. I understand how he tells stories. And so this movie is definitely, something really, really special and something really, really unique. Let's break down the film. Of course, first we have the black screen intro. Ben, you kind of helped me put this outline together because you had seen it more recently than I had. I think this is a very fascinating way to start the movie, because it to me, it feels wrong, because like people don't know that like we're this is like the introduction into what we're about to experience. Like it, you're almost, even the second time I saw it, you're just like, how long are we doing this? Like this is really uncomfortable. I really don't want to be here right now, which I think is an incredible like appetizer to, oh, you thought you were uncomfortable for that. Like here's the other 90 minutes that are much more uncomfortable. Ben, thoughts on the black screen intro?
Yeah. I mean, everything you said, just like it kicks it off and it just, to me, it was very jarring, you know, like as you're just sitting there, you're like, okay, like let's go. What's happening here? Yeah. You know? And just like, yeah, I mean, sound, all that kind of stuff. I just wanted to make note of it because it is such an interesting intro. There are movies that, you know, almost have like a cold open of sorts, you know, before we get into the title card and all that kind of stuff. But this one is just very like, no, you're going to sit in this for a little while and then we'll get going. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you think you're uncomfortable now, like just buckle in, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. What'd you think, Emma, of the intro?
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, all right, let's get past this. I want to watch the film. And then you watch the film and you're like, actually, I'll go back to the black intro. I don't want to watch it.
Very true.
Exactly. Yeah. Totally true. But
yeah, very, it's like super jarring. And yeah, another one of those like weird ways to kind of start a film. But I think it sets that mood where you're just like, I don't really know what to expect here, but I know that I don't like this. And you continuously feel like that throughout. I don't really understand what's going on here, but something is not right with this whole situation.
Yeah.
It's a really good precursor to the film, like stating, hey, I need you to buy in to like what we're doing for the next 90 minutes. Like you could, like, I just need you to be on board for this, because directly after this, of course, we get the, I think it's the birthday present that comes first. Ben, is that correct? When Haas gets his like canoe given to him by his kids,
the very first thing is the swimming at the lake. Like we just cut straight to them.
Oh,
at
right,
the lake,
right,
swimming in there, which in and of itself was such an interesting scene, especially to rewatch, because it's just amazing how quickly the sound design from this film kicks in. Because there are moments here where you're watching these people swim, just living their life, which again, after you rewatch, it's like, man, this is kind of like demented that they could just like go swimming and have a great time here. But the sound design, it got me on the very first watch too, where it's just like, is that a woodpecker or is that a gun? You know, it's like, I can't tell what that noise is. And that just like continues throughout the whole film where it's like, we're not going to tell you what it is. You could probably put it together, you know, but it's just like that's why I wanted to have us in here, because that moment really stuck out to me. It's like, is that a bird that we're hearing, or is that a gun in the distance? And like, I genuinely don't know, because like, we're just out in nature. How close are we to the camp? All that kind of stuff. But I just thought, man, what a way to start this out. There's these people living their lives, doing whatever, and just quite possibly listening to the slaughter of people, mm-hmm. however far away. It's just like, man, it was crazy.
And otherwise it would seem just like, wow, what a beautiful like afternoon and outing for this family and friends. Like yeah. in any other movie, it would just be like, this is such a beautiful like way to start a film. And unless you like really know where this film leads to, because I kind of went into it very much not knowing a whole lot. I was like, huh, what is this? Okay. And then, yeah, unfortunately later on, you're like, oh, okay, we're Nazis. Okay, yeah. Great, cool. Okay, that's it. Nice.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. It's a really subtle way, like you mentioned, Ben, of like, I don't know exactly what that sound might be, but like I can get an idea of kind of where we're going and what we're hearing. Kind of subtle introduction into that like safe, quote unquote, space of like, oh, okay, they are. They're just swimming. Like they're just having like a Sunday, a family Sunday. Like they're just chilling and just trying to take a load off from work, from a hard week and everything that might have entailed. Of course, later gets revealed throughout the film what that might be, and the stresses of a career and promotion and raising a family and all of these really intricate storytelling things that are all like underneath this veil of like, yeah, but it's not actually, you know, we're not actually here to just like be like, oh man, it's tough moving up the ladder, huh? Like, so I think that it is a beautiful way to start the film. It's beautifully shot. It's incredibly rendered from Glazer. The next on the list here is The Birthday Present, like I mentioned. This is where Rudolph, the dad, the commandant, is given a canoe from his wife and his kids as like a birthday present. And I'm curious for you guys when you saw the film, because when I saw it a second time in the theater, this scene in particular, like, got some pretty hearty laughs actually from people, because he chooses their youngest toddler to like be the first person to go in the canoe with him, which I think is quite funny. Again, like a very sick way of, you know, because I'm a parent and I have two young girls, and like, I get it as a dad. It's like, you got to go with the baby because nobody's going to get mad at the baby. That makes sense. Like you're just being a dad. I totally get that. And he gets a birthday present, and I don't know, I feel pretty good for him. He's like, cool, man. Like, your family loves you. They got you a fucking canoe. That's sick. Like, that's awesome, guy. I don't know.
I think it's interesting again on this rewatch because, you know, I think he asked, like, how did you get that? It's like, oh, I have my ways.
Yeah.
And then we learn what her ways are, like, after you watch it. Like, oh, shit. Like, this was someone else's. Like, you just like somehow got the, like, that's just, I don't know. There's just, again, it's another thing where I think this movie pays off so well. I promise I won't say it every time we talk, but like on the rewatch, once you've already established what happens, then you go back, you're like, oh, okay, I know what her ways are. And that's like kind of crazy that's how she's like, don't worry, I have ways of getting this stuff. So then, and just something that's like heartfelt family scene of like, hey dad, we love you, here's this. And it's like, oh my god, there's like this real underlying tone of just like darkness to this, but that's just the movie, I guess.
Yeah, I know that we'll talk a little bit more about Hedwig's scenes too later on throughout this, but she's such a fierce character. Yeah. And I don't even know if that's like a good word to, just a really vicious character, excuse me, who like every possibility that she has to like prove that she's a really bad person, she will take that. And we'll talk a little bit more about it, but yeah, it's just a lot of these things you're like, lady, why are you like this? Who are not following orders? Like, whose orders are you following to be this much of a bitch?
Seriously.
I think that's part of the brilliance of the screenplay as well. I know we talked about this, but like, her saying like, oh, I have my ways, that, you know, like if your significant other gives you a birthday present, they're not going to be like, oh, this, you know, I ordered it from Amazon 30 days ago and this is exactly like all the details for it. Like, they're just gonna be like, oh, you know, I have my ways. I figured it out. And it's like, oh, okay, great. Like, ordinarily that's like, oh, wow, you're so sweet. In this case, Ben, like you mentioned, that's like, oh, you're you're a very terrible person. Like, yeah. you're very, very bad. That leads us to our next scene, women picking through clothes. I think this is a great next scene to talk about because, Emma, you mentioned Hedwig, obviously played by Sandra Hüller, who is in Anatomy of a Fall. Two starkly different but unbelievable performances from her this year in totally different films, which is insane that she was able to do that. And this is where that she is just going through some clothes, trying to pick out a coat. There's a fur coat that she tries on. She brings up to her room. She tries it on in front of the mirror. And what I find so interesting and powerful and dark about the scene is she knows to do that by herself. She doesn't join the other people at the table. Yeah. She goes and has her moment and she finds like the lipstick in the pocket and she tries it on and then she wipes it off and she puts it in the drawer. She takes off her coat and then she like has her very encapsulated try on and then she goes back to life. And it's almost like she's trying to segment herself from the evil of this, you know, action that she's taking part in, and trying to just play it off as like, okay, I just like, I'm doing a little personal fashion show here. And once this like clicks, obviously of what it is and how she goes about something like this, I think this is really where Hedwig's story becomes, I don't know if it's more interesting, than Rudolph's, but I think much more dynamic than Rudolph's of the depths of like the kind of passerby evil that she's able to go through. This scene is pretty chilling.
It's, man, it's so interesting because she does something that kind of comes across as like a goodwill gesture to the housemaids or, you know, whatever their roles are. It's like, hey, you guys come pick a blouse, pick a dress. You know, you guys can, you know, have the pick of this. And then we cut to her in the room. It's like, oh, because she got the fucking fur coat. So then, like, mm-hmm. that's why she's okay to be like, you guys can have this stuff. It's like, I'm taking the good thing. And then just how chilling it is as she goes down the stairs and gives it to one of them. Like, hey, I need you to mend this and wash this. It's like, oh, because, like, it's possible someone got shot wearing this or something. You know what I mean? Like, but, like, fought to hold on to this and it ripped, like whatever it is, you can kind of infer what the story is behind this being taken off of somebody. And her solution is just like, well, let's just get it tailored and then I'll wear it after that. It's just like, damn, dude, that's fucking dark. That's so crazy. It's so dark.
And she like indulges in that moment too. Like yeah. her expression as she's like moving and trying on the coat is literally the same expression that I have as I'm trying on something in a fitting room. Like you're looking at yourself in all angles. You're like, oh, this looks really flattering on me. I love this. Like, it's just so like, it should not be that same type of like experience that women have in a fitting room versus her rummaging through, honestly, probably people who are dead or who have been transferred over to a concentration camp. Like, that should not be that same type of indulgence. Yeah.
I know, Ben, you mentioned that it has to get tailored, which again, I think is part of the really fascinating depths of this movie because Glazer doesn't go into that. Like, we don't spend any more time with the coat than like the 2 minutes that we're with her. But knowing that it has to get tailored, knowing that someone either died wearing it or died fighting to hold on to it. I think my brain goes to like, what is that story? Like, who is that person? Who did they fight off? How did they try to hold on to this coat? What did it mean to them? Was it a family heirloom? And now it's just being tried on like it's in a fitting room. Like, I think there's so many directions that you can go narratively with the things that Glazer doesn't inherently like talk about, which I think is really powerful stuff. Next on the list here is interesting. I really want to get your guys' take on this scene because it happens essentially twice in the movie. This is kind of the infrared of a girl going and bearing apples, I believe, kind of in the dirt. Emma, I'm gonna start with you. What did you think of this scene? What do you make of it? And like, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, it was another one of those jarring choices where it is infrared. And I think it has that like the sound, like the weird grumbling type sound, if I'm remembering correctly. At first, I wasn't sure the first time I watched this film because it was, you know, you take so much in all at once and then you have this stark change and you're like, what is happening? But I think the second time when I rewatched it, it seemed like it was a Polish girl. I think maybe one of the women who works for this family. Mm. Maybe she is Jewish herself, because I feel like there are some Jewish women who are working for the family at this home. And I apologize, it's been like a couple of weeks since I last rewatched it. But it's just, yeah, I still can't, you know, it's one of those things where like I like it because it is so stark and so different. And it does follow somebody who is of a different ethnicity and possibly Jewish. And, you know, it shows in such a strange way. And it's so just shocking to see those reverse of colors and just trying to figure it out. So it kind of still perplexes me, because I'm like, well, why did he choose to do it like this? Why does it show up like this? But it's also one thing that I'm like, but I'm kind of into it because it is so different. So I don't know how to eloquently explain it or like whatsoever, but it's just such an interesting choice, however you put it.
Yeah, I mean, ditto. I don't know what else to add to that. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's so visually interesting. Obviously, along with all the sound that we're getting here, but I think the second one is almost as interesting, if not more, because she hears the voices, I think, of the guards or whatever that are nearby, mm-hmm. and just like, yeah. It's almost like you can see or feel the panic in her face, knowing it's like pitch black, but obviously, like, we have the infrared on her, and it's just like, man, the risk that some of these people took, you know, to help out these others is just like, it's kind of just intense to even process. So I just thought it was like such a visually entertaining scene, though. Just like it's such a dynamic from everything else that we've been watching this whole time.
And they mention, you know, they say something about how like some of the people in the camps, like they've been like trying to steal apples from each other. And it's like, how are we getting these apples? Mm. So you get a little bit of that impact that is making later on in the film, despite never really seeing the outcome of people picking the apples and whatnot. So I think that's also kind of like really interesting little hints that have been put in the script too.
It's a super jarring scene. I think like that's the best way to put it. I think even after two watches, it's probably the most perplexing two like scenes of the movie to me, because it does like divest from focusing on Hedwig and Rudolph and like what we're doing, and goes in the other direction. But Ben, I think you hit on a really good thing of like the visuals of that and everything that is taking place in those scenes. You do feel like the panic, and you kind of feel this like, we have like divested from our little safe space, and now we're like doing something very risky. And I think on that level, it totally works, and you do feel that, because you can only imagine, at least as a viewer for me, I'm like, okay, if this person gets caught, like, where are we going? Like, what are we going to see? What are we going to do? How is Hedwig going to react? These types of things. We don't get to that, but I think it's there. It's like looming. So it's a pretty intense scene for sure. I'm still trying to like establish how I feel about it as a whole. But I think like artistically, it's a very smart choice. Next on the list, fishing in the river, and the bodies start floating down the river, and then Rudolph is basically like, we got to get the fuck out of this river, and we got to like cleanse our bodies and wash our eyeballs and like not get any of this disease, chemical, pesticide, whatever is floating down the river with these bodies on us. A very intense scene of like disassociating from work and family, which I think is very interesting for Rudolph especially, and pretty hard to watch, because you're just like, dude, like this you're doing, this is you, this you have caused this is what you're doing floating down the river. And it's a very interesting narrative for like him as a father and as a parent. Again, I think like it kind of like ties into that very first scene we get in the river of like he's just being dad and they're just fishing. They're just like trying to have a good time. And then their, you know, physical manifestation of their sins comes and kind of floats into their life, which I think is very interesting. Again, a really pretty difficult like moment in the movie to watch and just be like, oh, wow, this pretty like dark movie.
Yeah, without a doubt. And like, you know, I may have been incorrect on the notes here, if it was the bodies or like the ashes or whatever it was going down the river. But it is interesting that this feels like maybe the biggest hardship we see the family go through in the movie. And then you realize like, well, that's it. It is only because like these other people have been just like murdered and just like brutally killed, you know, all this kind of stuff. And that is like just how that's connected. Like these people just get the gross stuff on them, but they're able to go wash it off and like, oh, this is horrible. This is awful. And it's like, yeah, but you guys, that's because you killed all these other people. Like that's, it's like you said, it's a direct reflection of what you guys are doing to all these others. And yeah, I just thought, I mean, it's a super powerful scene, the kids, you know, crying and stuff and like trying to get all the stuff out of their eyes. And even him, we don't see him, but we hear him like blow out of his nose and just like land in the sink. It's like, oh my God, this stuff is everywhere. Like whatever this is, that's just, yeah, it's a very intense and powerful scene for sure.
Emma, any thoughts on the scene?
I really liked how you put it, kind of like a manifestation of their sins, where, you know, you can try to ignore it as much as possible, but like it's always there, and then it like comes, impacts them. And, you know, like the sound of like the kids crying in the bathtub because they're like having to scrub everything off of their body. It's just a really gross scene, like a number of different ways. Just the way that they're like, we know what this is, right? Like, do your children know that they have the ashes of probably children on them right now? And these were all kids and mothers and fathers and, you know, who knows what. It's just one of those things where it's like continuously this film will just remind you how disgusting this entire situation is. And again, it does it in like subtle ways, although I wouldn't say that this is necessarily subtle, but it's, you know, it's not addressing what it is.
I think this is interesting that this scene happens, and then the movie to me kind of feels like it goes a little bit more insular into like family drama. The next two we have here on the list are when Hedwig's mother comes. And I think I'm going to put these together. We can discuss them kind of as one, even though they're two different scenes in the film. The first one is when the mother comes, tours the garden. This is kind of like a very interesting look at Hedwig just telling her mom like, hey, look, we made it. Look at what we have. We have a beautiful house. We have a beautiful garden. Like, the kids are in school. This is great, isn't it? Like, I made it. I married the right guy. Like, we're successful. This is where we want to be. And she's kind of like being very proud of that to her mother. She says this will grow and cover everything. Of course, she's talking about flowers and things in her garden. And I believe she has plans to plant vines that like go up the walls to basically cover up the fact that there's cement walls, and kind of blend that into nature, which can be an entire dissection in and of itself. I think is a very fascinating thing that Glazer again does so well. Like, we just spend 4 seconds on that, and it's just like, oh shit, that's terrible. Like, you're just trying to let this fade into like the history of the world that is happening literally physically around you. And then the next one I wanted to put with this is when the mother leaves. Of course, she stays for quite a while. She leaves in the middle of the night. I believe it's after she sees the fires and the burnings taking place across the walls over at Auschwitz. And she can't even deal with that. She can't physically be present knowing she's associated with that. And she's staying in the home of someone who is managing that. And this is when Hedwig goes to breakfast, obviously very personally affronted that like her mother has just up and left in the middle of the night and kind of like abandoned her when she was so proud of the things that she was showing her mom. And Hedwig tells one of the maids or one of the housekeepers, I could have my husband spread your ashes across the fields of Babis. And really kind of for me the pinnacle moment where we see Hedwig is just like really uncut and just truly thriving on everything that Rudolph is doing, and how she kind of has this stopgap of like, she feels like she can do this because she's not directly reporting to the guy. Like, she is not reporting to Hitler himself or any of the higher ups that are making these very political career decisions for Rudolf and all of these things. I think it says a lot about their life that they're trying to live and what they're trying to do, of course. And I think it says a lot about the mother and this like kind of this removed state that she's in, and not even she can handle what is happening there. And she does have the choice to like up and leave. Pretty intense stuff.
That scene always kind of confused me, because I at first when I was seeing it, I was just like, does she just leave like in the middle of the night? I couldn't tell if there was maybe like some time had passed, you know, because I can't tell if like the film is like showing every single day or if there's like little gaps here and there. But I'm happy to hear that you also interpret it as her leaving in the middle of the night, because yeah, the visuals of that fire and just like the auburn sky, I guess, that that fills up, one is very beautifully shot, not very beautiful what is happening in order to elicit that. But yeah, it's just such an interesting way how your parent can be proud of the child, you know, to see that they are doing well, but even then they kind of look back and they're like, oh my god, my family is like, they're monsters, like how do you justify living next to this. And yeah, it's interesting because she sleeps in the same room as a granddaughter, I believe, or kid is knocked out, like doesn't even sense that something's happening, like it's just kind of like you know, like you get used to like the sound of a train passing by or like an airplane flying above, you kind of start to tune that out. But it's wild that you are tuning that out, the sounds of gunfires and the sounds of like, I don't know, like motorcycles being run to like tune out the sound of gas chambers running. So I love that that scene is in here to show, oh, okay, we're not the only ones who are noticing that there's something fucked up going on here. Like somebody else is like, this is a little too much for me.
Yeah. It's a super clear, I think, like audience engagement point where it's like, okay, cool, somebody else feels what I feel, which is really important, because we go most of the movie so removed of like, I could never imagine being in this situation or this life or whatever the case is. And I think that's really interesting of her character. I also think it's really interesting that like she, as the mother, has to wonder when she leaves and when she goes back home of like, how much did I help create that person that is okay with that? Like, how much of that falls on me as a mother? And like, what did I do to be able to for her to be okay with that? And I think, again, that's like Glazer's brilliance. I know we talked about like the coat and like, what's the history with that? Like, what's the history with the mom and like how she feels as a mother and how that relates to how she raised Hedwig? We don't explore any of that, but I think it's a really interesting question that the movie begs.
And how much has she like supported of their relationship? She knows that he is a Nazi officer and that probably even before Hitler started gaining power, that he was maybe part of like all of the World War One veterans who were like so angry with how that war ended. So it's like, how much was she okay with before actually seeing it in person? Like, you're still complicit in this if you're like, oh yes, my son-in-law, great man, he has a great position with the party. It's just, I kind of wish that we got to spend a little bit more time with the mother, but it's also very telling how quickly she wanted to get out of there.
I mean
I don't have anything to add that you guys haven't said already. I just, the scene was really powerful, especially with Hedwig just being so proud of her garden, things like that, and then her pride getting hurt when her mom leaves and she just chooses to retaliate. Like, that's how she does, like, well, all right, I'm gonna flex whatever muscle I have on these people that are helping us, and it's like, I could fucking have your ashes spread, you know. It's just like, okay, it's like, god damn, like it's intense. It's such a insight into who she is as a person.
Can you imagine? I would be very proud if I had that garden myself. But
yeah, it's
in
beautiful.
Totally different circumstances. Any other circumstance, please feel free to show off.
It's so nice. Could you imagine, like waking up and over breakfast, like that's your level that you're at? You're just like, I could spread your ashes. And it's just
where should day go from there?
Yeah, Jesus. You're in a bad spot for the day, I think, right out of the gate. Of course, there's lots of things. We only have two things left on this list. There's lots of things that we're not going to end up covering. Things that quickly came to my mind that I think are worth a shout out. You mentioned like the fires, especially that the mother is kind of watching transpire. We do get a scene where Rudolph Haas is working with the team on understanding a more efficient kind of fire burning mechanism tool that uses a lot of science and is very intriguing and is like, oh, that's pretty efficient. Cool. That makes sense from a business standpoint. And then you're just like, oh, wow. We're just like talking about how many more people we can burn. That's insane. That you're doing this in somebody's home. Your shoes are off, so you're very comfortable. You're in their safe space. And this is what you're talking about. The conversation between Rudolph and Hedwig kind of down at the river. I kind of want to use this as a lead into our next thing that we're going to talk about. This to me is the most kind of impassioned personal moment that we get in their relationship where Rudolph does essentially get the call of like, you've got to move. You can't be in this house anymore. You're getting transferred. He obviously doesn't want to be transferred. He's built up this really nice life for his family. And this is where Hedwig, again, like her character development and dynamic is so interesting because she kind of swerves. Like, I feel like up until now, she's been very loyal of like, we got you a nice birthday present. Like, I take care of the kids every single day and you go to work. And like, we have a very nice, efficient running home. He has to get transferred and she's like, we don't all have to go. Like you just have to go. Like I like what we have here. And that is a very fascinating stance to try to understand like, okay, who's worse out of these people? Is it the guy like actually figuring out more efficient like machines? Or is it like the wife who's like, this is good what we've built here and I don't want to leave it? I think that's really interesting. That leads me to the transfer phone call and gassing the room. This is after Rudolph has basically been transferred. He's able to kind of fight his way back and like get transferred back, I believe, like through kind of his ranks and everything. He calls Hedwig after he attends a party. And he calls Hedwig in the middle of the night and basically says like, hey, really good news. Like I don't have to do this anymore. This is so exciting. Hedwig honestly doesn't care. She's like, can you just call me in the morning? Like, I don't want to talk about this right now, which I think we'll get into here in a second. And I remember the first time I watched this, it hit even more viscerally the second time. He mentions like, oh, I was trying to figure out how to gas all the people in the room. And like the tall roof would make that a pretty big logistical problem. Yeah. And I was just like, wow, you're just like a walking terrible person. Like, I don't have the words to like express what comes over you to be like, yeah, let me just call my wife in the middle of the night and be like, man, I was trying to figure out how to gas this room of people. And I just tough solve. That's insane. Like so cold and so insane to me.
Yes. Something I picked up on the scene this time was, as he's on that second level looking down at the whole party, the sound washes out of everybody talking and it goes like completely silent. It's like, oh, is he like
genius?
This is when he's visualizing like, man, if I could just gas all these people, you know, it's like, oh my God, this is so, it's so intense. But yeah, there's also a moment that phone call is just so interesting. She's like, yeah, just call me tomorrow. Like, I just want to go to bed.
It's so
like,
wild.
Your husband just told you that he wants to murder this room of people, but the tall ceilings are the problem, and you're just like, cool, great, let's talk tomorrow. It's like, man, you guys just become so complacent or whatever in all this stuff. This is crazy.
It's just like a normal conversation where she's probably like heard that too before. Yeah. And she's just like what were the other iterations of the conversation? Oh honey, you are so brilliant, I love that. that would work so well. Yes. Yeah. To now where she's just like, I'm tired. Yeah. Just we'll talk tomorrow. It's you know, they're like, we have that one scene where the two of them are in bed and they're like kind of, you know, just having a nice couple talk, and you know, they like have a weird like conversations there. I don't know, she mentioned something about like wanting to go back to a spa in Italy. And then also with her mother, she says like, oh yeah, Rudolph calls me the Queen of Auschwitz. And it's just like, it's wow. like, wow, I don't want to know you whatsoever. Happy to not know you.
Super, super wild. I think for me, this is the scene that probably stuck the most. And I think it's a really fascinating artistic decision to like, to do this. And at least for me, I was like, we've maxed out, because at this time you're like, okay, we have like 10 minutes of the movie left. Like, what are we going to do? Like, where are we going to go from here for the final 10? And it feels like, okay, wow, we've gotten our point across. Like we are just a couple of very evil people, and we're just like living our life. And this is what it's boiled down to, is just like going to team meetings with your Nazi squad and then going to a nice cocktail party and then trying to imagine how you would gas people. Like, wow, okay, we've sunk pretty low. And then we get the truly just absolutely phenomenal Glazer decision to follow Rudolph down this set of stairs that he has troubles walking down. He ends up starting to essentially dry heave. And then we get a smash cut to the very same hallway, the very same building set in modern day. And it is now kind of this Auschwitz museum. And there's, you know, the glass with all of the shoes, and people are vacuuming, and the janitorial staff is dusting. And we have to sit with that for like probably 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. And then we cut back to Rudolph, and then we see him kind of progress down the stairs a little bit more. What I think is ultimately the most interesting part of this is that Rudolph himself, his body wants to alleviate itself of like the evil that he has so hardly become, and he is able to keep it down. He is able to live with that, and he's able to just drive, and like nothing comes up. He doesn't have to worry. He just like moves on with his life. And then of course the juxtaposition of like the modern day and how history is captured, and if that's not necessarily an appropriate way, but like a meaningful enough way to capture stories and history and events that have taken place, and everything that says, I think there's a lot to say there. I'm not going to divulge into a ton of it, but I think it is a brilliant way to end the film that ultimately leaves you pretty stunned and like just in silence after the credits start.
I think it's also quite interesting the way he shows the modern day, in that this place that was full of such hatred, like it's a place of work now. Mm. And it's like, that's kind of like, not necessarily like those people who are working there, but like maybe they too, like at this point, like they understand the gravity of that situation, but it too is like part of their everyday life. And it's kind of like an interesting way to like juxtapose those two, like, you know, everyday occurrences for these people. Like, I never once thought of somebody vacuuming at like the Auschwitz memorial camp, and like what that looks like, and the tours that are held there every single day. Like if I'm being totally honest, I didn't even think about that until we like started talking about it right now. But I think it's just such a very fascinating way for him to show maybe also like how today, maybe we don't view this place with as much gravity as we might. I think, you know, I think maybe the first time if any of us have gone there, or if any of us have plans to see it, I think that first time that you go, it hits you so much. But then you think about the people who are working there, like, is it something too that they're just kind of like, yep, I just gotta sweep up here. I pass by these shoes every single day. I pass by these atrocities. We're in a different place now. And of course, you know, history has come such a long way since then. And I think there is a much better understanding of the evils that were taking place. We clearly didn't see much of the evils taking place in this film. But it definitely leaves me thinking about that and like how we view that today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like two different versions of, it's just a job, you know, it's like, well, these people are doing, and yeah, it's just, it's a very interesting dynamic to put those next to each other. So Yeah, I have nothing intelligent to say about this other than just like it hits, I think, extremely hard if you're focused on what's going on. It's a great way to end the movie.
Yeah, it's intense. And then I think we end the movie as well with a similar but not as long lasting kind of black screen. And we kind of get this crescendo of a string instrument. And we're left to sit with that and work with what we just witnessed. I will say that kind of like those two scenes where he's talking about gassing the room and then kind of works his way down the staircase and feels like the physical manifestation of maybe what he's doing. And then we get the cut to modern day. That is my true cinema moment. I still think that is like the most substantial and powerful moment that this movie is able to deliver. But I think as we talk about it, there's just like so many small nuanced moments that come to my mind of like when the kids are playing and like the brothers, one of them locks him in the greenhouse and it's like, oh shit. Like you're just, that's how you guys play. Like you just think it's okay to lock people up. And like, sure, that's a pretty regular kid thing to do and like totally rag on your little brother. But that's also because like you kind of understand you're doing the same thing. Like it's happening across the way and like it's just been okayed. And so like, I think the movie is super powerful in eliciting like a really deep kind of like gravity and connection to it. Ben, do you have a true cinema moment you want to say?
I have like two quick ones. The first one is when the whole family is in the pool and in the background, we just see a train moving across with the smoke coming out. And it's just like, oh, this is just so interesting to watch visually. Like this family is just like having a Sunday or whatever, you know, like everyone's playing, going down the slide. And then there's a train full of presumably people who are coming, you know, that are just going to be slaughtered. And there's just no second thought to it. It's just like, cool, we're here playing in the pool. And the other one is when he's on the phone dictating a letter or something like that to someone.
Yeah.
And then he just ends it by saying, Heil Hitler, etc. You know, it's like, just wrap it up the way we always do. It's just like, that's insane to get to that point where you're just like, oh, yeah, you know, Heil Hitler, etc. All that stuff. So I just thought like it's a small fragment of what the whole movie is about, but just how, again, like complacent, just like normal this stuff becomes for these people. Like I cannot imagine ever just saying Heil Hitler, etc. You know, like at what point do you have to get to in your life where you're just like, yeah, that's just how I end things now. So those are my two.
Crazy. Emma, do you have a true cinema moment that you'd like to say?
I think that the lake intro that we get, just because, as I said, in any other movie, that would be like a really nice family moment and like a picturesque thing where you're like, oh, I wish I was there. But in this film, it like just shows, God forbid I am in this photo, because that means I'm associated with these people and the atrocities that are just happening mere feet away. And then we talked about the picking through the clothes. There was another scene in this film, not necessarily like a true cinema moment, but when he was like in the basement with one of the housekeepers, where it seemed like they were about to,
I'm glad you brought this up. Yeah.
Get down to business, so to say, kind of shows, you know, of course, can't really trust this man in any instance. Certainly not very faithful to his wife and his family, despite them probably just being like right upstairs, if I'm remembering correctly. It was just another one of those moments where it was like, again, are the housekeepers in this home Jewish women? Is this, you know, is this just you being able to abuse your power in that way too, or just in general? So there's just so many like really poignant scenes in this film. That's kind of hard to pick just one, but yeah, those kind of stand out to me.
I'm glad you called out that scene, because there's something at the very end of that when he kind of comes back home and he takes his daughter to bed and carries her basically to bed, and she says, "You're sweaty," and he doesn't say anything. And I think it's just like scary stuff. We're just like, oh man, like you just carry on with your life. And like, you don't even bother to be like, oh man, maybe my kid is going to find out or like be suspicious somehow or anything.
Whatever.
It doesn't matter. We're all
truly
good.
Whatever.
So
not the
crazy
worst thing he's done.
So crazy. Okay, we'll quickly talk about the best adapted screenplay race. We kind of talked about this at the beginning of the pod. We've got, of course, The Zone of Interest, American Fiction, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, Barbie, Ben, winner, and then second place.
Again, I guess comes down to I think maybe Oppenheimer is going to take it, but I'm curious to see what American Fiction can pull off.
Yeah. Emma, who do you have winning, and then do you have a runner-up?
I think right now I do have American Fiction winning because of the fact that it has garnered a couple of wins. Again, it could be Oppenheimer. I feel like you could truly make a case for any of these films. Mm-hmm. Barbie and the way that it told a much more heartfelt story than just a ad for a doll. Poor Things and its journey with womanhood. Oppenheimer and the gravity of the present moment, Zone of Interest and the gravity of the present moment. I feel like this is a really, really stacked category, which I hate because I don't know what to pick, but also it's it could be any of them. And I kind of love that. And they're all really deserving nominees, but I do think right now I'm leaning a little bit more toward American Fiction, but it could honestly just be Oppenheimer all the way, kind of how, Everything Everywhere All at Once last year was just steamrolling with every single category.
Yeah, probably much to my detriment. I'm going to stick with Oppenheimer and I'm just going to say it's going to go. We're just going to send it and it's going to take the awards. I can't wrap my head around the stress of trying to figure out which ones Oppenheimer is going to lose. I'm just going to say we're going to win them all. So we'll go that way. I think American Fiction has a pretty good shot of being second. I think it's really fascinating. I remember on nomination morning, Ben, we did a reaction pod, and I think both of us were pretty stunned that Killers of the Flower Moon did not make it into this category, which is pretty crazy. And of course there were much more interesting inclusions and non-inclusions in other categories. But I think that's interesting in this category for sure. I still think Oppenheimer is going to take it. Zone of Interest could have a shot though. You just don't know. I think that'll be fun to watch on March 10th for sure. Any closing thoughts from anybody on Zone of Interest? I feel a little bit more depressed than when we started this conversation. I'm just going to be honest with you guys. Did not raise my spirits.
I never want to see this movie ever again.
It's the highest compliment.
And I mean it in the best way possible. Right?
Yeah. Okay, this is interesting. Can I ask really fast? Because A24, obviously infamously known for, putting merch behind things and whatever, came out with a very nice set of posters for The Zone of Interest that sold out very, very quickly. Do we think A24 is going to they're going to make a collector's edition physical of this movie? What do they see as being how much people want to, hold on to this movie? Because Emma, you said I don't ever want to see this movie again. And I don't either. There's no point in the next year where I'm just great night to fire up The Zone of Interest. This is not going to happen. But I'm curious if they'll lean into that because people have responded exceptionally well to this film.
I would like that mainly because, This and Past Lives are its Academy Award nominees and its Best Picture nominee. And I, as we spoke, most likely going to win at least one Oscar, if not two. So I would hope that they would do that at least to commemorate that. Maybe not because, yay, look at how fun this movie is. But I think that would just be a really nice way to honor that. And did they do that with Everything Everywhere All at Once?
A physical collector's edition thing.
It took a while though. It took a little bit, I believe. Because Ben, I think you bought it and then soon after they announced the collectors and then you just ended up having two copies.
Maybe they'll have the collectors of Zone of Interest in time for the 8th birthday party. That could be the theme for the 8th birthday. So there it's like a Zone of Interest party. Yeah. All right.
we did it.
I love it.
Oh, man. Emma, thanks so much for coming to the podcast. This was as enjoyable as it could have been with the movie under the circumstances. Yay. Here. I seriously appreciate you coming on. It was great. If people want to find more of you, where can they find you at?
Well, first, I just want to say thank you to the both of you for having me on. It's always fun to, come on new podcasts, meet new people. So thank you so much for making this as an enjoyable of an experience as possible. But people, if you want to find my ramblings, which I heavily advise you not to because I don't because I talk too much, but you can find me on Twitter at Emma_Sasek, and then you can find my reviews at Next Best Picture, a couple of podcasts that I do with them too, and then I am at the Desert Sun too as an entertainment reporter.
Sweet. I love it. That's exciting. Definitely follow Emma on Twitter. Worth the follow. You predict things like I'm Just Ken being performed at the Oscars. So it's a great follow for sure. Next week on the pod, Ben, Best Picture number 10. We're doing it. And then we'll have final Oscar predictions about a week after that. We're ending with probably the saddest movie of the 10. And I feel like that's appropriate. We are probably just going to cry on the pod for like an hour.
But for me, we're saving the best for last. You know, I love Past Lives, my favorite movie of last year. So I'm
that was my
excited.
Favorite too.
Was
that
it?
Was my favorite too.
I'm so excited to talk about it. So
that was my number two. You want to guess what my number one was?
Oh, I have no idea.
Not Maestro. Yeah. Not Maestro.
Hey man, Maestro made it in the top 10. Okay. Come on, put some respect.
Yeah. All right. Well, what awards do you guys think Zone of Interest is picking up at the Academy Awards? Is it going to win Best Picture? Let us know. We're on Twitter and Instagram at 24 minutes of A24. You can also find us on YouTube. We can see all of our beautiful faces. We talk about these really sad, just heavy movies. But yeah, thank you everyone for your support. We really appreciate it. I am Ben Lawhorn.
And I am Ethan Simi. This podcast we enjoy is very much worth the sacrifice of pretty much nothing, just like an hour of our lives. But it's great.